Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Killer Psyche ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. A listener note, this episode contains adult content and is not suitable for everyone. Please be advised. On their wedding day, Carla Homolka and Paul Bernardo arrived in a white horse-drawn carriage. It was June 29, 1991, in a small town called Niagara-on-the-Lake in Canada. From the Cinderella carriage to the puffy sleeves on Carla's wedding dress and the huge white bouquet, it was as if Carla was trying to recreate the wedding of Lady Diana to Prince Charles. It was over the top, but the couple celebrated just like any other set of newlyweds ready to start their lives. To everyone that was there that day, the young couple looked like the perfect couple. The bride and groom seemed to be having a wonderful, perfect day. But on that very same day, the Mahaffey family was having the worst day of their lives, a heartbreakingly tragic day. Their 14-year-old daughter, Leslie, had been missing for 2 weeks, and they were desperate to find her. And they did find her that day, but not in the way that they had hoped. A fisherman and his son made the gruesome discovery. A block of cement with human remains was laying on the beach. When the police arrived, they extended the search and soon discovered more blocks. In one of those blocks, they found an orthodontic appliance, pieces of the braces Leslie was still wearing on her teeth, and they were able to use that to identify the girl's remains. So how are these two events related? Well, the picture-perfect newlyweds had just weeks before brutally raped, sodomized, and killed Leslie Mahaffey after kidnapping her outside her family's home. And we know this because they taped the whole thing. This was not their first murder, and it wouldn't be their last. When they were finally caught, the press seized on their good looks and crowned them the Ken and Barbie killers. From Wondery and Treefort, I'm Candace DeLong, and this is Killer Psyche. I've spent 5 decades studying people's minds through my work as an FBI profiler and psychiatric nurse. I've interviewed lots of murderers, including serial killers, and the question of why they did it is what I get asked time and time again. It's difficult to get a satisfying answer without diving deep into their mindsets. So that's what we're doing, and I will give you my best analysis in this series of what made them do what they did. This episode is Carla Homolka and Paul Bernardo, the Ken and Barbie killers. As a Killer Psyche listener, you'll love Audible's new pulse-pounding collection of exclusive thrillers that are guaranteed to keep you on the edge of your seat. With captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances, their titles are brought to life. I recommend The Killer Across the Table by John Douglas, my mentor at the FBI Behavioral Science Unit, and his co-author, Mark Olshacker. It is great. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/psyche or text psyche to 500-500. That's audible.com/psyche or text psyche to 500-500. Killer Psyche is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive.
It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I had a Barbie doll when I was a little girl. But when I played with her, I was alone in my room and I would close the door. I had three brothers. I didn't want them to know I was playing with a doll. Seemed kind of girly girl. I would play with her for hours, dressing her up in different clothes, making up situations. I would talk with her. I would pretend I was her. But you know what never happened? Not once, not one single time did my Barbie kill someone. So when I came across the case of Carla Homolka and Paul Bernardo, I was intrigued by their moniker as the Ken and Barbie killers. I studied the case and, well, I could only find two similarities between the killers and the real dolls. They were both blonde and blue-eyed, and they both had no ability at all to feel empathy or compassion. A few years before Paul and Carla met, there was a string of violent rapes in the city of Scarborough outside of Toronto. The rapists targeted only young women. All of the victims were between 13 and 23. The victims would be caught from behind and dragged into a secluded place, usually not too far from their own house. They were raped and then sodomized and were told not to open their eyes and not to scream or they would be killed. That's a common thing for a rapist to tell a victim. Every victim I've ever interviewed in the past 50 years said the same thing. He threatened to kill me, or I was afraid for my life. The rapist says that to the woman to gain her compliance. The attacks were horrific, but not just the sexual component. This rapist made sure that he instilled terror in his victims emotionally. How did he do that? He'd tell them after it was over to count to 30 and then they could open their eyes and he'd be gone. But he wasn't gone. He was hiding and watching. And when they started to get up, he would get them again. That is sadistic. That is enjoying the pain of other people. Doing this had very serious long-term effects on the survivors. This particular tactic left them with deep fears of being hurt anytime, anywhere, never feeling safe, always being on high alert. There is a type of post-traumatic stress disorder specific for rape victims, and it's called rape trauma syndrome. Because the rapist said, "Don't call the police or I'll find you and kill you," then they think he's gone and boom, he's right there again, reinforcing his threat. You are never safe from me. Rape trauma syndrome has a few different symptoms than PTSD. Oftentimes, a rape victim, her marriage falls apart or a relationship falls apart. It's not unusual for a rape victim to relocate, to move from the area where she was raped. That's called a geographic cure. If I get away from where the problem happened and where I was unhappy, I'll be happy again. So they move. But of course, that doesn't help. This is exactly the type of horrible fear that the rapist instilled in his victims. Throughout a period of 4 years, there were multiple victims that were attacked by what the police had dubbed the Scarborough rapist, but only the last one caught a glimpse of his face. She worked with the police to create a composite sketch, and that sketch was published in the local papers and was all over the news. As a result, many people contacted the police and said, "That composite sketch, that guy you're looking for, bears an incredible resemblance to a man I know named Paul Bernardo." The police called him in for questioning, but they failed to bring in the victim to do a lineup. However, Paul did give them a DNA sample. Back then, DNA was not as relied upon as it is today, and there were far fewer labs that could even process the samples. In fact, they would not get the results back from Paul's samples for nearly 2 years. If police had been able to connect Paul to the rapes in Scarborough sooner, perhaps he would have been off the streets and he never would have even met Carla Homolka. Carla Homolka was 17 years old and she was working as a part-time veterinarian's assistant when she met Paul. Friends that were there when they met described it as something electric going on between them, something very powerful. The attraction was intense, and they slept together that very first night. And although she lived a few hours away, they committed to a long-distance relationship. It wasn't long before Paul told Carla his sexual fantasies of rape and sodomy. Obviously, he trusted her. Most women would have been looking for an exit ramp at that point, but not Carla. She encouraged his sadistic tendencies, and soon she joined in. Paul told her that he had a real thing for virgins, but Carla was not a virgin. However, her younger sister, Tammy, only 15 years old, was a virgin. So she came up with a plan to kind of gift her sister's virginity to her boyfriend, Paul. In fact, the two girls looked quite a bit alike, and she thought that her sister would be a good substitute virgin for her. But Tammy was a minor. Sex with her would be a felony. So in order for Paul to have sex with Tammy, Carla stole animal tranquilizers and the insomnia medication Halcyon from her workplace. She waited until after a family Christmas party to set her plan in motion. Carla invited Tammy to have a drink with them, and she laced her little sister's drink with the Halcyon. But it failed to knock her out. So Carla held a rag doused with the animal tranquilizer, halothane, also stolen from work, and used that to render her little sister unconscious. With Tammy out cold, both Carla and Paul proceeded to rape her and sodomize her. At this point, Tammy was unconscious, totally unresponsive, and actually she was near death from the toxic combination of drugs. She gagged and choked and soon had no pulse. The couple panicked and redressed her. Then they moved her back to her own bedroom and called 911. Tammy was pronounced dead at the hospital, and the local coroner ruled it an accidental alcohol poisoning. In fact, in a subsequent autopsy, it was discovered that the cause of death was an overdose of halothane. It is also apparent that her body was not examined for sexual assault. Had that happened, this story might not even be told. Despite what happened to her own sister, Carla wouldn't stop. Carla invited a young 15-year-old girl that she worked with to her house and laced her alcoholic drink with the same drugs she gave Tammy. When the young girl, later known as Jane Doe in the trials, fell unconscious, Carla called Paul and told him she was giving him a surprise wedding present. When Paul came home, he and Carla both took turns sexually assaulting the young girl. The next morning, due to the halcyon, the young girl had no memory of the attack and blamed it on having her first experience drinking alcohol. Paul and Carla raped her again 2 months later, but that time she had a bad reaction to the drugs and almost died. In between the two rapes of Jane Doe, Carla and Paul moved on to their next victim. However, their next two assaults were very different. Not only in deed, but also in intent. The last two victims were murdered. There was no way for these murders to be an accident or even mistaken for an accident. Paul Bernardo kidnapped a 14-year-old Leslie Mahaffey from in front of her home. Her parents had locked her out because she missed her curfew, and they were teaching her a lesson. When Bernardo saw her, and he was out looking for a victim, he was able to convince her to get in his car and go with him to the house he and Carla now shared. Once they had her back at their house, they tortured and raped her repeatedly. After 24 hours, they killed her. Then they dismembered her with Paul's grandfather's circular saw. They packed the pieces of her body in concrete blocks that they made, which they dumped in a nearby lake. Not being very good at planning an execution, they filled one bucket with so much cement, it was too heavy to maneuver into the boat. So what did they do with it? They simply left it on the beach. And that's where it was found. Their third and final murder victim was 15-year-old Kristen French. She was walking home from school. Paul and Carla were driving around looking for a victim. It was Carla's idea to pretend to be a lost tourist, and she had a map in her lap. Was asking, where can we go? How do we get here? So Kristen walked over to the car. When she got close enough, Paul grabbed her and forced her in the back seat with a knife. He threatened her. Then they brought her home. For the next 3 days, they tortured and raped her. In the end, they strangled her to death. Then they threw her body into a ditch not too far from the cemetery where Leslie Mahaffey was buried. How do we know all these details? Because they recorded it. The rape, the sodomy, the humiliation, all of it. Rapists do this so they can go back and watch and relive it. It's exciting for them. If they don't have a victim, then there's always a tape they can watch. Because Paul and Carla did that, we have proof of the full extent and motivation of their unspeakable crimes. After Kristen French's body was found, Carla and Paul get into quite an argument, and he beat her with a flashlight, brutally. He showed no mercy. She was bruised and bloodied and had two black eyes that were swollen shut. She left him and went to a hospital, then to her parents' home. Little did Carla realize then that her two black eyes would be the best thing to ever happen to her. Around the same time, the DNA lab had finally processed the specimens of the suspects in the Scarborough rapes. One of them came back an exact match, Paul Bernardo. Now, with the DNA evidence, as well as information that his wife Carla had left him, investigators decided to interview Carla. The interrogation left her scared about exactly how much detectives knew, so she got herself a lawyer. She made a deal to tell them everything in exchange for a highly reduced sentence. Well, almost everything. In her version, she was simply an unwilling participant, a battered wife, and a victim as well.
Killer Psyche is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up for spring, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself too thin. Whether you thrive around people or you prefer some more alone time, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that does not drain your battery. Your therapist can help you identify triggers and appropriate coping mechanisms so you can continue to build helpful habits. Plus, therapy can be beneficial for everyone, not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/psyche today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/psyche. Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe as ex-homicide detective Roy Freeman. Freeman is forced to piece together the brutal evidence from a decade-old murder investigation. With only instincts to trust, he faces a chilling truth. Sometimes it's best to let sleeping dogs lie. I'm really looking forward to this movie. I have interviewed some people that had a fractured mind regarding traumatic events. This is going to be good. Watch Sleeping Dogs now on digital. on sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery. Paul Bernardo grew up with a very, very troubled home life. The effects of that on his psyche became evident by the time he was a teenager. His parents' relationship was toxic. It was rife with physical and emotional abuse. And Paul would later find out there were many secrets and lies in his family. His father was arrested and jailed for molesting a young girl, and he had also sexually abused his own daughter. Considering that sodomy was one of Paul's favorite things, it would not surprise me at all to know that his father also sexually abused him. The reason I say that is because when a rapist engages in sodomy and then they're caught, we frequently find out that they were victimized by someone else, that they were sodomized. The dad was known as a peeping Tom. That was a behavior that Paul copied as a teenager by reportedly peeping into girls' houses. What do we know about peeping Toms? They peep on people that they want to hurt. They're looking for a victim. They're looking through the curtains. They're looking to see if the victim is home. Sometimes they do this for sexual arousal, and sometimes they do it to get information. And it's very exciting for them. Peeping in someone's window in many places is a felony. That increases the excitement. Things were so bad at home, his mother lived in the basement just to escape as best she could the abuse and harassment from her husband. When Paul was only 16, he received shocking news from his mother. She told him that the man he believed was his father was actually not his biological dad. In fact, Paul was the product of an extramarital affair. This kind of news can be earth-shattering, could cause an identity crisis. Who am I? He was already in a very unhappy home, and now he had reason not to trust his mother, to trust anything about his life. This kind of thing could make a young man angry or happy. In Paul's case, it was bad news, and it had bad repercussions. Essentially, what he came up with was, women can't be trusted. Paul was clearly already on his way to have problems with women. This solidified it. Paul liked money and wanted lots of it. After studying accounting in college, he bought many books on how to get rich quick. But his fantasies went far deeper and darker than just money. He was infatuated with the 1991 novel American Psycho by Bret Easton Ellis, about a Manhattan investment banker who's also a serial killer. Paul considered that book to be his personal Bible. Paul was not a loner. He was popular and charismatic. He and his friends would go out drinking to bars, and they would practice their techniques on picking up women. Then one night, Paul met 17-year-old Carla Homolka. She was visiting Scarborough for a pet food convention for her employer. Not surprisingly, they immediately hit it off. It's like I often say, for every predator, there's a perfect victim. Except in this case, she was a perfect partner. How does someone get to a place where they murder their own sister? Well, let's take a look at her background. Carla Homolka was the oldest of three girls. Her parents reportedly doted on their daughters, and there were no reports of any mistreatment by them. As far as anyone knows, she lived in a happy, healthy home. Carla was said to be outgoing and very strong-willed. She stood out not only in attitude, but she was rebellious in the way she dressed and carried herself. Her friends saw her as a leader. They described her as tough. One of the things they said was that you never want to get into a fight with Carla because she always wins. She belonged to a clique. They called themselves the Diamond Club, which was so named because they all wanted to marry young and marry rich.
Carla got a part-time job at a pet store, and it was because of that job she was at the convention where she met Paul. Carla was infatuated with Paul, and after getting over their initial resistance concerning the age difference, which was 6 years, Carla's parents welcomed him into their home. They even called him their weekend son. But let me tell you something about a 6-year age difference between a young man and a teenage girl. One of the things the FBI learned about psychopath predators was that they frequently hang around younger people when they are young. What is a 23-year-old man interested in a 17-year-old girl for? He can control her. Also, young girls look up to older men. For them, it's really cool. Hey, my friends will admire me because I've got an older boyfriend. After she became more serious about Paul, she changed some things in her life. She changed her appearance. She wanted to be more trendy. She had brown hair. She went back to her natural blonde. She became more mainstream in her look to please Paul. She also changed her mind about going to college. Now she wanted nothing more than to marry Paul and have children with him. But during this time, Paul's sexual appetite was not satisfied by just Carla. Paul was raping young women in his hometown of Scarborough, and his attacks were becoming increasingly more violent. After his arrest, Paul told police that early in his relationship with Carla, he once teased her. He asked her, "What would you think if I told you that I was the Scarborough rapist?" Her response, "That would be cool." There is a clinical term for women that are attracted to dangerous men. It's called hybristophilia. And according to the American Psychological Association, this means the person has a sexual interest in and an attraction to those that commit crimes. It turns them on. This is a type of paraphilia, and there are many types of paraphilias. We discuss one of them in relation to the Craigslist killer, John Cateas, in our 12th episode of Killer Psyche. I believe John had a very violent fetish. In Carla's case, she gets sexually excited when another person commits a violent crime or deviant act. To be clear, it is only hybristophilia if the non-criminal offender is aroused by the idea of the criminal committing a murder or an offensive act. It's not just that they are attracted to a criminal, but it is the criminal's actions that turn them on. Clearly, this is very, very dangerous. If someone with hybristophilia hooks up with someone who is a sexual predator, nothing good is going to come from it. Now, I don't know if Carla has that condition, but her relationship with Paul and her subsequent relationship in prison with a man who was serving a life sentence for strangling his ex-girlfriend to death certainly do point in that direction. The forensic psychiatrist that Carla's defense team hired offered this as an explanation for her behavior. However, even if she did have this paraphilia, that does not excuse her involvement with these murders. The paraphilia is only a condition. Any behavior that springs from that condition is 100% controllable by the person, in this case, Carla. But it's clear Carla liked dangerous men a lot. Greg McCrary, a behavioral criminologist and former FBI profiler, was called in to consult on both the Scarborough rapist case and the murders. He said that predators like Bernardo have a highly attuned ability to find potential co-conspirators. He calls it murdar, kind of like radar, but much worse. When these types of individuals meet, they also bring out the dark side of each other. Once they meet, the dominant predator tests to see how far the potential co-conspirator is willing to go. For example, Paul suggesting to Carla that he was the rapist everyone was afraid of. McCrary explains that this process is exploratory, so if the other person reacts badly to the test, it could be shrugged off as, "Hey, I was just kidding." But Carla did not react that way. In fact, she liked it and she encouraged it. This gave Paul free rein to do whatever he wanted, and ended up making them a deadly team. More than one-fifth of serial killers act as a team. According to a former prison psychologist, Al Carlisle, the relationship they have is characterized by an interdependence in which both parties need something critical from the other person. Kind of a give and take. I'll give you an idea and let's see what you say. And usually these partnerships become more emotionally significant than any moral code that they might have. So committing a crime becomes much easier for them. I've noticed it since I was a kid. Sometimes people will do things in a group setting, and two can be a group, that they'd never do alone. They have a partner in crime, and that validates their ideas and behaviors, no matter how horrible they are. But it also offers the offenders, each one, the ability to say, well, wait, this wasn't my idea, it was his idea, or she made me do it. And that reduces their culpability in the crime, at least in their mind. Paul's cruelty to his victims and the emotional and physical torture that he inflicted on them leads me to say with certainty that Paul Bernardo is a sexual sadist and a psychopath. Everything in his history and his actions fit that diagnosis. Had he not been caught, there is every reason to believe that he would have killed and raped many more women. It wouldn't surprise me if down the road he started kidnapping more than one woman at a time. Ted Bundy did this. Why? After men like this commit what they think is their worst event, they have to do something even grander. What's grander than killing one woman? Killing two at the same time. Carla, however, is a little more complicated. One of the psychiatrists examining her before she was incarcerated noted that, and I quote, "she remains something of a diagnostic mystery. Despite her ability to present herself well, there's a moral vacuity in which it is difficult, if not impossible, to explain." I disagree, and I can explain it. Like most psychopaths and most psychopathic killers, Carla is a trickster. They can put on a really good front to those around them. Carla wants those around her to see her in a particular way. Carla would actually wear her hair in pigtails to make herself look younger. She'd also dress as a schoolgirl. She seemed to be going for the innocent, sweet schoolgirl look. This was not who she was. She was a calculating sex offender and killer. It was generally thought that Paul was the leader in this relationship, that he was really the evil one. But I have to tell you, not so much. Carla was known by her friends to be willful, to be controlling, and she was mean when she wanted to be. She was also known to not back down. One friend relayed a story that, well, it's horrible. When she was a young girl, Carla threw her friend's hamster out a second-story window with a homemade parachute that she had made. She wanted to see what would happen. The hamster died, and her friend was devastated. Was Carla upset? Was she apologetic? Was she remorseful? No, she was not. Not one little bit. Weeks later, she would even dig up the hamster to examine it. She blew off the death of her friend's pet and her friend's emotional reaction as no big deal. She would later show the same nonchalant attitude when confessing her horrible crimes to the police. There came a time when Carla felt that Paul's attention and devotion to her was flagging. She knew he was obsessed with her sister and virginity, so she cooked up a plan to offer her sister, her little virginal 15-year-old sister Tammy, to her boyfriend Paul. Later, Carla insisted that she did that because Paul was obsessed with her and he pushed her to do so. But her third sister's boyfriend described an incident before Tammy's death. Carla had been watching Paul and Tammy snuggle together on the sofa and she snapped. She screamed at her little sister, "Get the fuck out of here and leave Paul alone." Apparently, it was common for Tammy to be flirtatious with Paul. And it made Carla not only very jealous, but furious. But Carla's instincts about Paul and her sister turned out to be right. One night, Paul and Tammy went out to get beer and returned 6 hours later. Paul admitted to Carla that he and Tammy made out. Someone like Carla could never lose a lover to another woman, but that it was her little sister was humiliating. It was shortly after this incident that Carla decided to gift Tammy to Paul. But instead of just encouraging Paul to have sex with her sister, she concocted a plan to drug Tammy into submission. The drugs and the dosage that Carla gave to Tammy were lethal, and she must have known this from her work. Carla also admitted to having a good working knowledge of halothane, the anesthetic she used. She read the warning labels and instructions at work as a vet technician and understood exactly how to administer the drug. It's written on every bottle's insert that it can cause death from overdose and must be administered with the exact dosage. Also, there's a huge chemical burn on Tammy's face. That suggests that a rag soaked with halothane was pressed against her nose and mouth for an extended period of time. This means that there was a real possibility that she intended for this to be lethal. In my opinion, Carla's psychopathy was driven by malignant narcissism. We talked about this condition in regards to Paolo Macchiarini, the criminal mind in season 3 of Dr. Death. When she felt that Tammy was trying to replace her with Paul, she could not and would not tolerate it. For a malignant narcissist to be humiliated and publicly is intolerable. They cannot handle it. If we are acting under the assumption that Carla knowingly and deliberately killed Tammy, then it makes sense that she would hold the halothane over her face. I watched a confession of Carla explaining the halothane rag. She said it was never on her face, that it was 12 inches away from Tammy's face. That's clearly a lie. Not only that, the videotape of Tammy's rape and death shows that Carla was clearly enjoying the assault. But wait, it gets worse. Later videos of her sexual encounters with Paul show her in Tammy's clothes, pretending to be Tammy. She even went as far as laying in her sister's bed as if she were Tammy's dead body. It does not take an advanced degree in psychology to conclude that Carla had no compassion, empathy, or remorse for what happened to her sister. She felt no grief. And all of that means she's a psychopath. Why do I say that? Why isn't she a sociopath? Remember, psychopaths are born, sociopaths are made. There is no indication or information or evidence that Carla was abused, neglected as a child, or had traumatic events happen to her. None of that at all. In fact, in a letter written to a friend of hers only 2 months after her sister's death, Carla tells her friend how angry she is that her father is still grieving and does not want to put on a big wedding. Carla believed that he was wallowing in his own misery and only thinking of himself. That's her narcissism talking. She doesn't even see the irony of her own words. This lack of empathy and compassion for others is a hallmark trait of a psychopath. When Carla was giving her confession to the police, she was very disturbed by the fact that Paul and one of their murder victims drank from their good champagne glasses from France. Carla said to them, "We hadn't even used them yet. That made me angry." She didn't even seem concerned that the reason that woman was there was because her husband brought her home for the purpose of raping, torturing, and killing her. For a psychopath, things are far more important than people. When a video of Carla drugging a friend with the same drug she gave her sister was uncovered, it revealed that Carla was more of an accomplice than an unwilling participant. Carla initiated this assault and seemed almost giddy in the video that she had done so. In fact, Dr. Fred Berlin, who is a sexual disorder specialist from Johns Hopkins University, believes that Carla might have actually been the driving force behind the three murders the couple was eventually arrested, charged, and convicted of. He points out on CBC's show, The Fifth Estate, that, quote, when Paul Bernardo was alone with numerous victims, he had the opportunity and never killed any of them. The only time that people ended up dead was when Paul was in the presence of his wife. He went on to say, I don't know who did the killing. I do know that women and men are equally capable of doing evil and doing wrong. And in this case, in this particular instance, I'm not certain that fact was appreciated. I have to agree, especially considering the outcome of the trial.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
With the DNA evidence pointing to Paul as the Scarborough rapist and the questions the police were asking her in her interview, Carla knew that the police were on to her and Paul. When he beat her the last time with a flashlight, she had left him and gone to live with her parents. I don't know if she would have gone back with him if the police had not come to question her. But it was clear to Carla that it was time to save herself and make certain that her side of the story was heard first. So she confessed to the crimes, but put the majority of blame on Paul and painted herself as the battered wife and unwilling accomplice. There's a term FBI profilers have for unwilling accomplices, and it's called the compliant victim. We see this a lot in devoted wives who are abused and beaten, and they will go along with anything their abuser wants. However, I do not think this is the case with Carla Homolka. After Carla's confession, the police arrested Paul. Unfortunately, the officers in charge of the case did not allow Paul to call his lawyer. As a result, the original 8-hour interview was not allowed in court. They needed substantial evidence against Paul. They searched his house for 71 days trying to find the tapes that Carla revealed existed, but she didn't tell them exactly where the tapes were. Without the tapes, prosecutors were not aware of exactly how much of a role she played in the crimes, and therefore they let her plead to a very reduced sentence. She pleaded guilty to 2 counts of manslaughter and was sentenced to 12 years in prison. What the police and prosecutors did not know was that after they concluded their search, Bernardo's lawyer went to Paul's house and retrieved the videotapes from behind a ceiling-like fixture in the bathroom. The lawyer then held onto the tapes for 16 months before turning them over to Paul's new attorney. When the tapes were finally turned over to prosecutors, the evidence was clear. Carla was not a compliant victim. She was a willing participant. In fact, sometimes she was even the instigator. Carla's duplicity was exposed, and the image of Carla Homolka as a victim was quickly dissolved. However, the prosecutors decided to honor the plea deal. The judge banned the media from publishing any of the details on the case for fear that it would damage Paul's right to a fair trial. Of course, that made the public desperate for information. So when the news broke about the content of the tapes and Carla's plea deal became public, people were furious. Paul Bernardo was found guilty of all 9 charges against him, including 2 counts of first-degree murder in the deaths of Kristen French and Leslie Mahaffey. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole for at least 25 years. He has been denied parole twice. Carla was released on July 4th, 2005, after serving only 12 years in prison. She then married her lawyer's brother, and they had 3 children. She tried to disappear into a normal life. She changed her name and her look, but the press found her working at a school in Quebec in 2016, which drew criticism and anger from parents. Carla's ability to basically get away with murder has infuriated many people, and they keep tabs on her through social media. They believe she is dangerous and should not be allowed on the streets. Greg McCrary, the FBI profiler who worked on the case, has said that he has come to see that Carla may be more psychopathic than Paul Bernardo, and yet she's walking free. I think there's a very dangerous serial killer living among us. Her past 16 years of non-offending may or may not be significant. She is now divorced and living apart from her 3 children. She knows she is being watched. But if she meets the wrong guy, there's no reason to believe that history won't repeat itself. If you like our show, please give us a rating and review. Follow Killer Psyche on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen 1 week early and ad-free. In the episode notes, you'll find some links and offers from our sponsors. Please support them. By supporting them, you help us offer the show for free. Another way you can support the show is by filling out a survey at wondery.com/survey. From Wondery and Treefort Media, this is Killer Psyche. Next week on Killer Psyche, I'll be covering Mark David Chapman, the man who killed John Lennon. If you don't want to wait, you can listen to it right now and ad-free by subscribing to Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts or the Wondery app. I'm your host, Candace DeLong. This episode was written and produced by Lisa Ammerman and Julie Burke. Edited by Michael Schatz with Maxwell Carney. Our senior audio producer is Tom Monahan. And Haley Mandelberg is production coordinator. Brandon Clark and Lindsay Whistler are our production assistants, and the line producer is Oscar Guido. Our executive producers are Kelly Garner and Lisa Ammerman for Treefort, and Marshall Louie and Aaron O'Flaherty for Wondery. This series is produced by Wondery and Treefort Media.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.